Okay.
This is recording. Do you guys have a theme song yet?
We still do. We did last time, too.
Oh, that's right. You have one. That's
cool. We put it in post. I don't know if Zach could. Can you still play? Can you play through, Zach? Can you play the song while we so that we hear it?
No. I will sing it for you guys, though. Are we all synced up?
Yeah.
It's so professional.
I know. It's all the little tricks of the trade that we picked up over 217 episodes of podcasting.
Good Lord. Has it been 217 episodes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Congratulations.
We are now here, ladies and friends.
We are born to be kings.
Game of Owns.
What brought on the Game of Owns nickname?
Ooh.
I'll ask you the questions.
Oh, that would be great. Just interview us.
That would be really
awesome. So this is reverse psychology. Is that it?
Yeah.
Well,
what's your favorite Brian Cogman penned line?
Actually, Brian, I was going to say this for later in the show, but I actually have the answer to that question.
Boy.
If you'd like to know,
answer it, Eric. We're at the beginning of the episode. People want to know.
Let's start on a high note.
All right. Here it is.
Tenterhooks.
You can't trick me. Tell him you couldn't trick me.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's a good one.
That's the angry.
I like that line.
Yeah, that's well. I like Theon, and people know that. But without further ado, I think
actually.
Yes.
But hold on a second, Brian. Have you seen our Facebook cover photo?
Oh God, no.
I don't. No.
We need to get you a link just for 1 second. We can pause here and show this
I'm
to
so
you.
So embarrassed.
Oh, okay, here we go. Let's see what we got here. Wait, where did you do that? What is that?
There's silence. I don't know why there's silence, but there's silence.
Where did you take this? What is this? Where did you?
This was just 2 weekends ago at C2E2. It was a Chicago Comic Entertainment Expo.
Oh, that's funny.
The trick or the Easter egg in that is that I'm wearing a hoodie that says Navy, and the Ironborn are, of course, seafaring.
Oh, yes. It looks like a school photo. Like, it looks like...
That's what I said.
You know, it looks like a yearbook. Like, you know, it's the chess club.
They pose together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, very, very, very good. Yes, Alfie's a sweetheart.
Oh, I was going to say, you would have to be to put him through all the stuff that he goes through in this show.
Yeah. I mean, we pay him, too. So,
oh, okay. So, yeah, there's that.
That helps. But no, he has been an amazing sport. I mean, there's... A lot of actors are, this is a news flash to many of you and your listeners, but a lot of actors are very vain. And I think a lot of actors wouldn't put themselves kind of through the sort of physical and emotional anguish that Alfie has had to over these past couple seasons. So I'm really very proud of him. I think he brings 1,000% to all those scenes.
Brian, do you ever have a situation where an actor reads a script that you've written and just like slowly looks up at you? It's like, damn it, Cogman.
Well, I'm not present while they're reading it for the first time generally, so I can imagine them. No, I mean, I think our cast is, I think they're genuinely excited for each new script, because the show we like to think is never the same show twice. So I think they enjoy being pushed and having their storylines changed up and their characters' arcs, you know, fluctuate so wildly. So you know, I think they generally respond positively to what we ask of them. Thank God.
I know you've spent the past few days talking vigorously about this most recent episode that aired on Sunday evening that you did have full control and responsibility of writing. Mm-hmm. In some stretch,
yeah,
of the imagination.
Entirely.
How was it?
Well, I didn't have full control. I never do, but let's make that very
everything
clear.
Everything was your decision, yeah. Every single thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And
everything.
You played every role, everything. As I remember.
I played every
also,
role,
yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah. All, you know,
you were a great dog. When you bit the cage, I was like, yeah, damn, that's vicious.
Definitely.
That's very intense.
You were a very,
that's
very
Juilliard
sexy
training.
Cersei. I just want to put that
well,
out.
Well, you know,
great,
I,
Cersei.
I'm a chameleon. I'm thrilled with the response that the episode has gotten. You know, I mean, it was always going to be a big one, and you know, we've been doing this now for, I mean, I'm about to go back for my sixth summer in a row doing this show. If you think
congrats.
It's like camp.
Yeah, it's crazy, because counting the pilot,
it must
the
be
original
rough,
pilot.
Right?
I mean, it's a little rough. We've had two little kids in the time that we've shot the show, so it's moving every year for half the year is not easy, but it's, of course, you know, the greatest job in the world. But yeah, we've been doing this for so long and wanting to get to some of these scenes, you know, since the beginning. So, and season four is chock full of those major sequences that we've been teasing and teeing up and laying the groundwork for, you know, laying the track for, you know, the entire time. So the trial is certainly one of those. And then, the I'm guilty of being a dwarf speech is, of course, was another one that we've been just building up to forever. And so to finally get to do that and share that with the book readers who've been wanting to see how we interpret it. And of course the newbies, it's really been a thrill and it was, you know, a great honor to get to adapt it.
Right. Well, we last spoke to you about a year ago, almost exactly. And you had hinted, actually you told us outright that you were doing two episodes, this season. And of course you couldn't say where they were or what they were, but now we know.
Now you know. Yeah. At this point this is when we're back in LA and we're writing the new season and you're catching me right at the time where I'm just freaking out about everything and, you know, convinced that it's the worst thing I've ever written and all that stuff. But that's part of the process.
So you're writing four episodes next season, right?
No. Just two.
Okay, back with the two. Well, I think both of your episodes have been standout episodes. And I have to say, if I'm guilty of one thing here that will upset you, I think I have to say episode four is still my favorite. So it's one of yours, but it's not the most recent one. I love episode four, Something Wicked.
It doesn't upset me at all. I'm very fond of episode four.
I'll also go on record saying that I know that all of us, I think, are to some extent fans of the books. And I know that there's been some mixed feedback from fans of the books. But as a diehard fan of this series for I don't even know how many years at this point, I absolutely respect the changes that have been made. And I think they've made for a better show. And frankly, I think the silent majority feels the same way.
Well, thanks. We'll see how you feel as the season goes on.
Look what I just did.
No, thank you. I mean, it's a very tricky thing. You want to make the decisions that are best for the show and for telling the story for this medium. And as the series goes on and as the books get bigger and the canvas, you know, grows larger, you sort of have to make tougher decisions and adjustments. So it's been a challenge, and you know, I appreciate all the feedback as long as it's nice, which for the most part it's been really respectful, even the negative. So but it was a tricky, you know, Oathkeeper was whereas Laws of Gods and Men was a pretty clear episode in terms of adaptation. I mean, even the new stuff, it was sort of cleanly laid out when we outlined it, but the Oathkeeper was a tricky episode in that it had a lot of plot lines to service and a lot of information that we had to dole out. And so it was probably a harder script to write than six.
Is it the case that when you invent these new situations, these new scenarios, is that something that George has to sign off on? What's that process like?
Well, he receives, he's not in the writer's room with us when we break the season, but he, you know, looks at the outline when we're done and gives his feedback, and we go back and forth, and we have a healthy, you know, communication with him when we're planning out the season. But, you know, a lot of this stuff, the seeds were laid out even earlier. I mean, we had an idea that we were going to follow the mutineers, last year when we cast Bern Gorman as Carl. So, these things sort of take root at various times while we're shooting and writing. But, you know, it's a tricky thing to do, but you have to remember all of these sequences and new scenes are still rooted in clues from the books or events from books or even, you know, little nuggets of something that George might give us in the books. I mean, mm-hmm. the mutineers, mm-hmm. when they attack, when they kill Mormont in the books, you get an idea of the subjugation of Craster's wives even in that scene, which we didn't include in the scene, in that particular scene when we shot it.
Right.
But it's certainly what inspired the kind of nightmare scenario that the wives found themselves in four, which, you know, was in terms of difficult scenes to write and to shoot, that was certainly one of them. That wasn't a fun experience.
Right.
That was pure chaos in Craster's Keep.
It was. And it was even worse. You know, Robert McLaughlin, the DP, has alluded to this, but I mean, believe it or not, we really cut back on what we actually shot. It was a lot worse.
So is this the episode that the violence was dialed back?
Scene where, that he's talking about.
Wow.
You know, what we shot was even more awful. And I think Wisely was scaled back a bit in the edit and focused mainly on the principal players, and you got an idea of what was going on. But there was kind of a big establishing shot of the real kind of horror that was happening at the keep before Carl started his monologue at the skull.
I'm a fucking legend.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Which
everyone
I
knows me.
I'm a fucking legend in Ginnelly.
So did this allow you then the opportunity to sneak in that, you know, snippet at the end there, which really kind of threw everybody for a loop.
Oh, the White Walkers.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what was that like to get that information? Is it something that George himself provided you with, and then you kind of took it from there? Or, you know, how did that all fit in, and was your mind blown a little bit, finally getting to get a little bit more insight into really a people? I don't know if you call them a people, or just kind of an area that we don't necessarily see as much of in the books.
I can't really discuss the big picture of it all, because it affects the future. So I will say, I think the placement of it was deliberate in that, you know, we're in season four of the show. We've been teasing the Walkers and the looming threat and the return of the Long Night since really the first scene of the series. Mm-hmm. And from a storytelling standpoint, in terms of television, I think you need to keep all those balls in the air and give the audience something new, you know, or reveal something a little more about this, these beings, if you will.
Yeah.
So that I think is what dictated kind of the placement in terms of the overall arc of the story. I certainly was blown away when I finally saw it cut together, because it was shot, you know, it was shot in a field in Northern Ireland with green screen. I mean, that entire section was just an amazing piece of work from our visual effects department. And of course the Walker costumes are not visual effects. Those are costumes, you know, those are body suits and prosthetics. And
that was you, wasn't it?
Oh, if only. Yeah, that was your big scene. I should have gotten a cooler cameo. I cameoed this season. I'm the waiter in Dragonstone, but you can barely tell.
Oh, no way.
It was so lame. It was lame. I should have held out. I should have been one of the guys that drilled Dantos with the crossbows. I don't know why.
Yes, because that would have been so much cooler.
They should have CG'd your face on the baby.
So much cooler.
Yeah.
Right? Well, oh, you know, God, anything's possible. Thankfully, my cameo was so unnoticed that I can probably do another one and it won't really screw up.
We won't tell anybody.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have the same guy playing Martin Lannister and Tommen, so I can play two cameos.
Should we go to that question that we had that was kind of centric to what we just mentioned there?
This is from a user on Winter is Coming. The user is named Lim D. For Brian, there were a few notable recastings this season, Dario Tommen, The Mountain. Since making the world of the show as real as possible is so important, how do you handle bringing in new faces in old roles?
I mean, the main way we handle it is to just not comment on it and just bring them on.
Smoothly.
You know, I mean, in the case of Tommen, I can speak to that a little bit. I mean, we knew that starting with this season, Tommen was going to be a, you know, major character, mm-hmm. with a lot of dramatic weight on him. And Wee Callum, who played him beforehand, was terrific, but we needed someone who I think was more of an experienced, you know, actor. And also we knew we needed to age him up a bit to play out the dynamics that we've already seen with him and Marjorie and
Sir Pounce.
And of course Sir Pounce. So that was the thinking behind that. And then Dean had been so terrific in the tiny roles, the Lannister hostage last season, that the guys just thought, well, let's just offer it to him, because he's a terrific actor. I mean, he's just got amazing instincts and works, you know, I mean, blended seamlessly with our existing cast. So, so that was the reasoning with Tommen. You know, Dario the Mountain, it's not really appropriate for me to talk about, because it's, you know, behind the scenes production stuff, and, you know, but you know, again, the mandate was just, you know, this is the new Dario, and it's funny. It happens a lot more on British shows. It throws people less there than it does in America. I'm not sure. I think it's just more common to have a new face playing the same role on some UK shows. But, you know, I'm very happy. I think Mikael's doing a great job as Dario, and I think everyone will be very happy with the third mountain.
Well, I have to say the scene with Tommen and Marjorie is probably my favorite from that episode, and there were a lot.
Thanks. I love that scene.
Yeah, it's great because it's really, like, innocent. Like, I think Marjorie treats it with the appropriate level of respect, and she's there to obviously, you know, she's there for a purpose, and the purpose is served really well, but at the same time, she realizes that he's still very young and innocent. I think the kiss on the forehead really sealed that for me. And then, of course, Sir Pounce.
Yeah, she, you know, Marjorie is very good at reading a situation and reading people and knowing exactly what buttons she needs to push and what levels she needs to play. And Natalie is the same as an actor. She's just got incredible instincts and she really just nailed that scene tonally. I mean, I remember when I was presented with writing it, I thought, oh God, how am I gonna write this scene?
Right.
And actually, Sir Pounce was a lovely little solution to a lot of problems.
I hear the filming
was
very smooth with that cat.
Oh God, nightmare. Well, for one thing, they, you know, I always pictured Sir. I should have been more specific in the script. I pictured him as a kitten. I pictured him as a little kitten, and they cast a sumo wrestler cat that then couldn't hit its mark.
What does that mean, though? Just had trouble jumping on the bed? Is that what it was?
Yeah, in that it wouldn't. Yeah,
you got to use treats. I'm telling you.
They tried everything.
Fish base, chicken base.
And the cat was scared of the candles that were there by the bed. It was just, oh, man. But you know, as a device in terms of the scene.
Breaking the tension.
Great. He broke the tension, and it was a way for them to start talking about Joffrey. It was a way to sort of visually drive home Tommen's innocence. And so, I was glad to get him in there because I knew, you know, fans would enjoy it, but the main reason he was in there was because he served the scene. Mm-hmm. I had no idea he would get the kind of response he got, though.
Yeah.
I'm constantly surprised by the fandom of the show.
Oh yeah, it's just a good thing that Marjorie didn't do what Olenna had told her that she did to throw a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which also was just a hilarious scene. It was brilliant, I think, in really its humor for her.
Well, and again, I think that's a nugget from the book that I just took and expanded, you know.
Mm-hmm. It fit very well.
Yeah, Olenna in the book makes a sort of throwaway comment at one point about being engaged to a Targaryen, but she got out of it. And so
right.
I just, you know, took that nugget that George provided and built it
that actually ties in really well to another question we got from winterscoming.net. It's from Dragon Reborn.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, Flying. Episodes of Game of Thrones are like movies with their own theme, repeating and reflecting through various characters. Besides obvious references to the titles, there are crazy details, most of which we fail to notice. How can they achieve this with so many characters and storylines? And you know, what this immediately made me think of was in the middle of Sucking Face, batshit crazy Lysa Arryn, you know, brings up the fact, yeah, I killed Jon Arryn. And yeah, I told my sister it was the Lannisters who did it. And it's such a, we talked about this. You know, how it's such a big revelation because it really showcases how Baelish was responsible for putting most of the series into motion.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, it's just kind of a minor detail it's there if you're paying attention, but it didn't necessarily blow up like something along the lines of Joffrey dying.
Yeah, I think that was sort of on purpose. It was kind of in terms of where it was presented in the episode, and it was almost thrown away, but that was kind of the point, was that in a way it's all the more shocking. It's revealed a little differently in the books. It's revealed in a scene that hasn't aired yet, so I don't want to talk about it. But the idea in this scene was sort of that Lysa was kind of getting off on talking about their crime together. It's almost it was almost a riff on one of those scenes in an old film noir like Double Indemnity or something, where, you know, it's you and me, babe, all the way. We you know,
come over here.
We killed him when we got the money, and now we're going to
You've
South America.
You know what I mean? Totally. Like,
yes,
and that's
yes,
what it perfect. Is. That's what it was meant to be. And Kate Gerley got that. I remember Michelle McLaren and I were on set kind of talking about that dynamic when they were, and that she's sort of getting off on saying it out loud. You know, the danger of that, and of course, all Peter is thinking is stop talking. Stop saying it out loud.
Please shut up.
All right, I better fucking kiss her. You know,
I know. I love how he didn't kiss her. He was like, not affectionate at all, but she starts talking about the crimes that they committed together, and he has to shut her up.
Yeah, that was a fun. That was a fun thing to. And then, as you say, if the minute you stop to think about it, you go, "Oh my God, that they did it. They started this whole thing, the entire story. It's all them." And he's been, you know, the puppet master this whole time. Mm-hmm.
That was the big shock that I think shook, I know, Eric and I, because we're behind the book readers, know this, and they've known this since the beginning of not only the series, but since we've done this podcast. And I just feel like the weight has sort of been lifted. We have a person to kind of point at when it comes to a lot of different things. But now I'm just feeling so much dread because I know that he is capable of so much more.
Brian, you mentioned earlier, you were talking about the scene between Tommen and Marjorie, and I wanted to ask, you expressed a certain amount of your own dread about writing that episode, like, oh, how is this going to go?
Yeah.
I was wondering, is there a particular scene that stands out for you in your memory as being extraordinarily difficult to write?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was that Craster's Keep section in 4.
Oh, okay.
Without question. It just because of the sheer depravity of it.
Exactly.
And it's just ugly, and it's meant to be.
Well, I was going to ask you what the atmosphere is like when you guys are filming those scenes. What's it like on set?
Well, it was rough. I mean, it was that whole Craster's section between over episodes 4 and 5 was, I want to say almost close to 3 weeks of night shoots, out there in muddy Craster, just mud pit that is the Craster's Keep set. Yeah, I mean, it's very grim, and you want to make sure the actresses and a lot of those were background extras that, were cast locally who really were just phenomenal and threw themselves into it and really went there and, mm-hmm. With not only the sexual assault, but just the sort of psychological trauma and all of the gift of the gods. And they really, really worked very hard and I think did exceptional work, but, you know, you stage a scene like that and it's a very technical, you have to, just make sure everyone's feeling safe and knows exactly what's going on. And
your sandwiches over here if you get hungry.
Yeah. You know, but I mean, there's just a lot to it. And Byrne Gorman had this, huge 2-page monologue and
which was awesome.
And he was amazing. Yeah. He's an amazing actor and
very good
and a very nice guy. Luke as well.
Despite both what of them. You may think.
All the worst ones are.
No, and Luke, Luke hated having to do that stuff. I mean, because he's a sweet guy and then the stuff with the baby. So, it's a really just dark, awful thing. But so shooting it was not fun. Now, thankfully, Michelle McLaren is an amazing professional and as we all are, I hope to think. So, we got through it, but I remember, in between takes, we'd sort of look at each other and be like, whoa, this is awful. But
let's burn this place down when we're done.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I was ready. Yeah. Oh man, listen, I was ready to light the match. I mean, it's just a hard set to shoot on. It's an amazing set, but it's very cramped inside there and it gets very hot with all the lights. And so I can't imagine. Kit and Byrne's fight in episode 5, I mean, Kit has said that it's the hardest fight he's ever had to do in his career because it's a very, very cramped space. And he's got that big broadsword. And it was a technically very challenging fight because of the knives and all of that. It was a tough one to shoot. And it was shot, I think it was only shot in a day.
Wow.
So, we don't have much time to do this stuff. So, but writing that sequence, that Craster sequence was difficult too. It was in the original outline in the first draft, it actually opened the episode, which we realized once we read the script that was an enormous mistake because it was so grim and featured characters we didn't really know very well that to start the episode with that would just, I think be deaths.
Right.
The guys wisely asked that maybe I put it at the end and put Danny at the beginning. And that was,
Well, that worked for us, I think, I remember, because, I mean, the previous episode ended with Danny, so it was nice to open.
Yeah, and you want to pay off that fleeing of the collars. I think you want to pay that off right away.
But with Carl, we were just talking about a minute ago, I think it's important for the show to have these villains that, I mean, they die horrible deaths. They're evil on screen. It's important to see them doing bad things, but then they die. It was that way with Carl. It was that way with Locke. I mean, we have so many kind of guys we care about that are dying on the show, from mm-hmm. time to time, that it's occasionally very nice to get this juicy death of somebody that we hate.
Yeah, 5 gave us three good deaths with Rast and Locke and Carl and yeah, it was a lot of plot lines and themes and teeing up for the future and paying off the past that we were kind of going for with that whole kind of northern mini plot that went over 4 and 5, and it was logistically pretty tough, but I think it ended up being okay.
It felt great. I thought that it fits so well, and how dynamic Carl's character began to feel. I just remember people saying, who the fuck is Carl Tanner? And then it's just like, well, he's this guy that's doing this at Craster's Keep right now. And then we got to sort of visit with him those few episodes.
Yeah, you need an actor with that kind of memorable gravitas like burn to pull it off, because it was a short arc, and it kind of needed to be, I think, any longer with those guys, and you just want to slit your wrists watching it. So.
Well, I think we can say confidently that he will actually go down as a legend now.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it was
incredible. Not just of Jin Alley either.
Well, he made his mark. He made his mark.
And a mark was made on him.
Yeah, and a mark was, yes, through him. Through him.
A permanent one.
Yeah.
Yes.
You mentioned payoffs, but I really feel that this season is a lot about that, but also about things coming full circle. You know,
we've absolutely
talked about the White Walkers a little bit, and going back to episode one of the season. Also, Jon Arryn going all the way back to episode one of the first season. You know, do you get that sense too, in having written, you know, these two episodes, that a lot of season four is about tying up some loose ends that maybe have been lingering for a long time?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a reflection of the book series. I think A Storm of Swords, you know, if you look at kind of the life of the book series, I think Storm of Swords in many ways is kind of, you know, yeah, you're paying off plot lines and sort of seeds that are planted as early as you say, as episode one, and not just plot stuff, but even character stuff, like with the Arya and the Hound. You know, there's sort of the two of them and their journey together, and what they're learning from each other, and how they're so kind good. Of bumping up against each other. Yeah, I love it, and it's all character. It's really not plot driven at all. It's just sort of living with the two of them and seeing, you know, what their shared experience and how that affects them. But it's also a way for the two of them to reflect on their journey thus far. And so as an audience, to sort of reflect on the audience's journey thus far with these characters. Littlefinger and Sansa are similar as well. You know, I think it's kind of these twisted mentor-protege relationships that with the Stark girls and these guys that are really starting to bear fruit now. That's something. That's certainly an element of season four. The trial is another one. I mean, you're seeing Tyrion's whole life kind of being thrown back at him in that trial. And not just that, not just the stuff that we as an audience have witnessed with the testimony, but under the surface, and I've talked about this in a few of the interviews, so apologies for anyone listening who's heard me say this 15 times, but it was very important that scene be about the Lannister family history and the legacy of the Lannisters and the kind of life that the three Lannister siblings had with Tywin, and all of that is happening under the surface in and being reflected in the looks of between the four characters. It's essentially another scene altogether without dialogue. It's happening concurrently with the trial scene.
You know, I noticed that on a rewatch that their looks really are telling with each other.
It's its own thing. And Alec Sacharoff was very conscious of that when we were shooting it. And it's very satisfying to me when I watch it, because that was definitely what we wanted, you know, to get out of it when we wrote it.
I'm guessing that that sort of cannibalization of the Lannister family that's going on in this particular scene is the reason why the Reigns of Castamere was chosen to round out the episode.
No question. I mean, it's a Lannister family episode. I mean, it's the first episode without any Starks. I mean, it's really kind of...
Which blew our minds, I think.
Yeah. And it's something I didn't even realize that until we finished shooting it. I thought, oh my God, there's no Starks in this episode. But it really, you know, George kind of does something tricky with you when you're reading these books. He makes the villain family the protagonists of the story without you even knowing it. And they are. I mean, they are the central family of the story. And, you know, and Tyrion, Cersei, and Jaime are the protagonists. That doesn't mean they're heroes, but they are the protagonists.
I know that we spent the better part of Monday's episode just speaking about the trial, because there was so much inside of it, and there was so much weight obviously put on this pivot right toward the end of the episode. And I've seen around the web, people are just so disappointed that they felt like it ended early. And that's a good sign, because there's so much left to desire after that final shot, not only of Tyrion, but the shot of Tywin and Charles Dance's portrayal of Tywin finally being like, this is a move I didn't expect.
The rage behind his eyes, that his plots have been, he's not used to having his plots foiled, and to have it done by him, of all
in
people.
In front of gods and men, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I, you know, it was very, I mean, that's the last, the last two lines of the script, or, you know, Taryn and Tywin face off, and Alec beautifully, portrayed that. And yeah, I think it's that. And it's a lean episode. I mean, it is. I think it's one of the shortest episodes we've ever done.
A lot of people are saying this is their favorite episode they've ever seen so far.
Wow, that's very nice to hear. I mean, I love it as well. I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's
Well, I have to ask, Brian, you called it a lean episode. Was the siege of the Dreadfort initially, like, any longer? Was there any more to that in the script?
It was a little longer. It was definitely... definitely leaner in the edit, which isn't really my department. I'm not really involved that much in post, but although it was always kind of meant to be a rather abrupt sequence, it was sort of meant to kind of throw you. You think it's going to be this big triumphant. You think what Yara thinks. You think it's going
to
be
right. And that's a payoff to what she said seasons ago or last season. You know, she's like, "I'm going to take
50
of our best killers." You know,
yeah. No, it's meant to sort of take the wind out of her sails, no pun intended.
that was
but it is. I mean, it's the idea that it's sort of what we talked about a second ago with Tywin. Like, she's not used to losing. She's never lost in her life. She's always been a sort of classic Ironborn warrior. And what she did in defying her father and deciding to go for Theon is surrender to a kind of sentimentality or loyalty or a love to her that she didn't know she had for her brother, and it backfired. And now she has to live with the consequences of A, softening enough, and B, when faced with this botched thing and faced with the choice, instead of choosing to die there, she chooses to run because she doesn't want to, she doesn't want to die in that kennel, which she would. Mm-hmm. It's not just about the dogs. The dogs are more of a symbol of what Ramsay's going to do. She's not leaving that castle alive unless he lets her. And I think he does let her. I think he's sending a message.
I mean, he took on five guys bare chested. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, he's crazy.
It reminded me of when he let the girl run through the woods and he was hunting her.
That's what it is. And it's also the sending of the chopped off member to Baelon last season. He wants her to make the choice to run, and she does because she realizes, she's like, I could die here with this thing that was my brother, or I could go and, I'm now the heir. She sees in front of her what her father already knew, that she's the only one left. She's the heir now. But that said, Ironborn are not, cutting and running like that is not necessarily an admirable trait in an Ironborn warrior and a leader of men. And she's going to have to, live with that and deal with that. So that was the idea behind it. The abruptness and the everything going wrong really fast was very much on purpose. And also the kind of claustrophobia of that little fight scene in that space. The original script called for a kind of more expansive fight in a courtyard. And that's one of the cases of, budget kind of dictating and location and kind of dictating the rewrite of the scene. But I think it ended up working really well.
Sure.
It was very intense.
Yeah. I think you can very much see that it's really Ramsay's whole game here. He's being rewarded by finding out that Reek is really truly his.
Oh, yeah.
Loyalty.
Oh,
yeah. Now, I mean, that's a secondary result of that. I mean, Yara, obviously, she sees him. She takes one look at Theon, and with him shouting, you can't trick me, and I'm not going, and I want to stay. Mm-hmm. She knows that that's not her brother. And when she says, my brother's dead, it's just very, I don't blame her for leaving because Reek is that far in. And the fact that it serves to show Ramsay that he's got a loyal, pet now, just more than ever, is scary.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's of course followed up with that bath scene. This is the next phase in their relationship. Mm-hmm. And
bath time.
Speaking of bath scenes, I wanted to ask, how do you determine in your episodes which characters get bath scenes?
Are taking baths?
Seems to be,
isn't that funny?
The dirtiest ones, egg. Obviously.
I've somehow become the bath episode, right? It's a total coincidence.
Just blame it on
Ryan. You
gotta
sneak a rubber duck in there at some point.
Yeah, Ryan. That's Ryan's fault.
Because he never bathes. He's just like wish fulfillment after he's writing the scripts.
Exactly. I guess on a more serious note or more serious type of question, these episodes are at times so dark and you get these moments of comedy. And obviously I'm not talking about the Reek Ramsay scene. I'm talking more about
the
Davos Solid or Sand scene.
Oh yeah,
it was just awesome to watch.
Anytime you can bring in some humor into this thing, you have to. I mean, and Oberyn is a great, you know, kind of vehicle for that as well. But yeah, we love Lucien, and we love the chemistry that he has with Liam. And we knew we kind of wanted to visually, you know, to dramatically show the result of the Iron Bank scene, as opposed to, you know, the Iron Bank just saying, "You've convinced us, Davos. We'll make you a provisionary loan." Right. It's more fun to then, you know, show him actually putting some of that money to use. And we figured, well, if we're going to show him putting that money to use, we should show a character that the audience has some investment in. And it just sort of grew from there. And then the scene was, okay, well, where does he find Davos or Saladar? Well, he's finally enjoying some R&R.
It's relaxing.
exactly. And it's just sort of, okay, well, R&R, well, he's in a tavern. He's in a brothel. Oh, well, you know, nothing is more relaxing than having a bath. So it became, you know.
After Blackwater, I think a few of us would probably choose to take a bath.
Yeah. And that was the idea. It's like, he's in the most comfortable place he could be. Everything's finally going his way. He's enjoying some time off, and here comes Davos.
In that scene, Liam's happiness was just absolutely just beaming, and I thought that was a great representation of what happened, and it ended up happening at the bank because he was so happy.
Yeah, I mean, Liam is wonderful. He brings, there's so much warmth that he brings to Davos. I mean, my other favorite scenes are the ones he shares with Shireen. He's just one of the few characters in this thing that is a truly honorable, and whether or not you agree with the character he's backing, he backs him 100%. And that bank scene was a lot of fun. I mean, again, it all comes back to George. Like, you know, no one else would think to explore the financial background of these things, but you know, I mean,
right.
But it's rooted in history, and you know, wars are expensive, wars are paid for, and the Iron Bank is such an inspired creation, and we just wanted to bring it forward. You book readers will know that Tycho Nestoris and the Iron Bank representatives don't appear until much later in the saga. But we felt, you know, we're in season four. We've been teasing the Iron Bank ever since, I think, episode 3 of season 1. So,
It got a mention in pretty much every episode this season, I think.
Well, we really start. Yeah. I mean, that was very much on purpose. We amped, we amped up the casual mentions of the bank a bit
more. I was definitely expecting it
to really set up that scene. But, you know, the bank has come up. I think Littlefinger first brings it up in the first small council scene that the crown is in debt.
Oh, wow.
So, we just figured this was the right time, and it would be a juicy dramatic scene to show, you know, one of the proudest characters in the show having to, you know, appear hat in hand on someone else's turf. And
that is big. And for him to be turned away as well at first and not have really anything to say for himself, he doesn't know how to proceed. And then Davos, who just loves him, shows them the hand, you know.
Well, it shows him, it's, you know, it's an illustration of, you know, why he needs Davos, why he keeps him around, you know, and the, you have these sort of two forces in Stannis' life, Melisandre and Davos, and then they both bring very different points of view to the situation.
That reminds me, I wanted to ask Melisandre, you just mentioned, like, does his religion, do you think Stannis' religion is or would be an issue of contention for the bank? Or, I mean, is that something that paints him kind of negatively as a character because he's going off sort of on this religious quest as opposed to his birthright? Or what do you think about that?
Maybe. I mean, you know, I certainly the bank would have gotten wind of the fact that Stannis has
beach parties.
fallen in with this red priestess. And you know, I don't know if it would necessarily, it probably didn't help. I mean, in the end there, they're looking at the numbers, as they say. And what's kind of fun about the scene is that Davos manages to convince them. He manages to sort of bring them around a bit with something other than numbers, which is kind of, I mean, in a way it is because he talks about their relative age, but he, you know, his powers of persuasion go a little bit beyond that. And it's also important to note, and this is implied a bit, but it's perhaps not totally clear. The bank is not now abandoning the crown and, you know, throwing in with Stannis. I think it was a, I think it was a provisional loan. I think it was, okay, well, here's half of what you might have wanted. See what you can do with that, and we'll talk.
Feed your men, for crying out loud.
and there might be more where that came from if you show results, but, you know, they're not gonna put all their eggs into Stannis's basket now.
It definitely looked like Davos would have been swimming home, though, if he wasn't able to do a little bit of convincing.
Perhaps. I mean, I think there's that look, that great look that Stephen gives him, like, okay, thanks for bringing me here.
Yeah, we sailed this entire way for this. They don't even need this table. We're not using it.
Well, oh yeah, I love that touch. That was an idea of David and Dan's, this idea of this table that exists purely for intimidation. There's nothing on it. There's, you know.
Davos was heroic in this scene, though. It honestly felt like watching Don Draper trying to win back Big Tobacco. He sold it, and it was.
That is a very Mad Men scene, isn't it?
It was masterful. It's like he didn't necessarily have crazy dramatic stories about his childhood, but he did have those fingers to pull out, and that won some. You know, that won a few votes. He was like, "Look at this!"
Absolutely,
it was beautiful.
Yeah, I like that scene.
I did want to ask though, what was it like introducing Braavos? I mean, this is a place that's been talked about all the way back in season one with Arya, with Syrio, with Jack and Hygar. You know, it kind of has spanned all these seasons, and now you get the opportunity to introduce it to everybody.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, we wrote the Iron Bank scene, and I honestly didn't think that establishing shot was going to make it past the edit. I thought, well, I'll write a scene of them sailing in, but I bet it'll be an easy one to cut.
Oh, man.
It's not essential, and you know, maybe they'll want to save that for some other time. And I figured it wouldn't happen. And then to my delight, they kept it in and kept surviving the drafts. And it's a fairly simple stage direction in my script. It's really just, you know, they're on the boat, they sail beneath the great Titan. And I mean, it's not much. And then they just, then that shot, I mean, I blew my mind. We screened the episodes at a friend of mine's screening room, and so I got to watch it on a big screen, and I hadn't really seen it. I'd seen bits of it in the commercials, but in the trailers, but oh man, I mean, it just blew my mind. But I can't take too much credit for that, because a lot of that was just our amazing visual effects department. And, but I, you know, yeah, I was happy to get, you know, first crack at that part of the world for sure.
I think that establishing shot was so essential.
Yeah. Oh no. You look at it now, and it's essential. And you know, a funny thing, and it wasn't originally the first scene of the episode. Originally, the first scene of the episode was the dragon and the whole Dany.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Which was great, but yeah. I assume once that establishing shot was finished, it was decided in post, oh, there's no way we have to open the episode with this, you know, and it was the right choice.
I know it's TV, and I know that, you know, like you said, a shot like that can necessarily, okay, well, this is something we can trim if we need to trim it, but those kinds of moves are sort of a Game of Thrones signature, where the extra care is being put into it for the sake of everything just being good and just being better. It's just better that way.
Oh, well, yeah, I agree. And thankfully, you know, a few seasons in, we have more resources to be able to afford those kinds of shots that we would have been less likely to afford in season one. So.
Oh, yeah. But Braavos is totally amazing. And I wanted to point out, even during the opening credits, you know, when we first see Braavos, it's actually, I don't know if you guys noticed this, there are coins like running.
Yeah, there are coins running down, like, yeah,
the structure to, like, and they land in a pot that's like a piggy bank. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like one of those you know, like science experiments you see. In
yeah,
up there.
Yeah, like a gumball machine or a Goldberg experiment.
Yeah, that was a neat touch. I enjoyed that too.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, Braavos is again one of George's most inspired creations as a place, and the history of it is fascinating. And as you say, it's been part of the fabric of the show since the beginning with Syrio, Pharrell. So, it was fun to kind of open up that corner of the world.
So in your season, in your episode last season, Kissed by Fire, we had the Jaime and Brienne, bath scene, but the great, great scene between the two of them. And I wanted to mention in Oathkeeper, when Jaime gives Brienne the sword and the armor and Podrick, which of those gifts do you think is the best, by the way? This is my question, but what do you think is the best gift?
Oh, well, I mean, if you've met Daniel Portman, you know. well, I mean, certainly I think it's undeniable the power of Ned Stark's sword being used to hopefully find and defend Ned Stark's daughter. I think that's, you know, coming from the man that pushed Ned Stark's son out a window. It's a very, charged thing for many reasons. And the relationship that Jaime has with his father and all of it. I mean, there's so much kind of swimming in that exchange and in that gift, and not to mention the shared history between Brienne and Jaime. So that was a joy to write. I was very lucky in that, as you say, I had the pleasure of scripting arguably their most important scene before the bear rescue, and so to get to kind of pay off their storyline, and send her and separate the two of them and send her on her new journey was really a privilege. And Nikolai and Gwen are good friends, and I'm very close to both of them, and I, you know, worked very closely with them on the scenes in the previous season. So it was just nice personally to be able to write that. But I wasn't on set. I wasn't on set for that final goodbye scene because it was shot in Croatia and I was covering Belfast. So, I was very nervous because, I mean, I knew Michelle and the actors would be great, but it was a very important scene to me as a writer. So I wished I could have been on set.
Right.
But then I saw it and I was just, you know, I was a blubbering baby.
Well, thanks for putting that grin in, that Podrick.
Oh yeah. I mean, that was a Michelle touch.
Yeah.
I mean, I did write the smash cut to Podrick, but that grin was, I mean, just amazing. That sort of became that little mini Jamie arc sort of became the spine of the episode. You know, your question or the viewer's question earlier about each episode sort of sharing, playing with common themes. That's great when that happens. It's often by happy accident in a funny way. I mean, we lay out the season more in terms of kind of where the characters need to be when, and it's more of a puzzle. And then as the scripts are written, those themes sort of emerge and you realize, oh, this is that. And that is that, you know, that, and then a lot of that also comes in the edit. So, you know, when the episodes can kind of work on their own and make their own kind of statement, that's very, very gratifying. It isn't always possible due to the nature of our show, but I felt like that episode did. I was very happy with it for that reason.
So on the last Game of Owns that you were on, which was episode 92, you mentioned, you said you liked writing for Jamie the most. And you did say you enjoyed Alfie, but you said you found writing for Danny difficult. I want to know, a season later, has that improved at all? Or like writing for Danny, or are there any other characters that?
Yeah, Danny has, improved maybe is the wrong word, but I now that her story is sort of taking a different turn and it's becoming a little more political and a little more of an examination of this idea of what it takes to be a ruler and her being a sort of alien in this new culture, those themes were very interesting to play with, and I had the chance to sort of kickstart that with the audience chamber scene and his Dar coming and arguing for his father's proper burial and all of that, which is kind of a riff on a similar scene in Antigone. So
that's a callback.
You know, playing with those kind of classic themes, I had a lot of fun writing that. And you know, Amelia, I mean, it's always wonderful writing for her. It's more that the storyline before was I had trouble finding her voice maybe at first.
Mm-hmm.
But I really enjoyed writing that scene. Yeah, and just, you know, characters facing kind of hard choices, that's always the stuff that's kind of most delicious. And you know, in season three, and this is very much the point of season three for Danny, was that she was resolute, you know, and very firm in her convictions. And that was absolutely the idea, because she had to be the conqueror and be the leader that these people can get behind. That said, it's more interesting for me as a writer to kick her off her pedestal and make her question her choices and put her in a vulnerable place.
Exactly. No, I thought it was played really, really well, and it was written really well in the scene. And you see that she's having to peel back some of those layers and kind of rethink and maybe for once listen to her counsel.
Yeah. And Barristan is a guy who has served many kings before, and he knows kind of when things can go wrong. I mean, he served her father. And so there's a lot behind that line about, you know, sometimes it's better to answer justice with mercy, you know, and Ian McElhenney, who's a real student of the books, he's a big fan of the books, and he's the kind of actor that can put that years of history behind just one reading of a line and you get everything, you know, and then the reaction he had when she made her decision. That's why we have the best cast on TV, is they can convey, 40 years of a character's history in a look, you know?
Right.
And that's, and you need that because we don't have a lot of time to go into the 40 years of history. So.
No, I was just going to say, I remember, we've talked about this. There was an interview that he did. It was leading up to the season. I was just blown away by how much he knew, or, you know, intimated about what happens in the books and just that.
Yeah. And it varies from actor to actor. You know, some of them, it, different actors do what they need to do to, for their process. You know, some want to know everything about the books and about the character and about the world. And some of them really want to just take it script by script and be in more of a place where they're surprised and you know the essentials that they need to know, but really want to just treat it. I guess it's kind of the difference between a book reader viewer and a non-book reader viewer. And it works. It works either way, you know, but it's really just up to the individual actor. There's certainly, I don't think there's one that's better than the other. It's whatever gets the results that we want.
Well, it seems to be working.
I hope so. I think so.
You know, we did get a bunch of questions from social media. I know you saw we asked both on Twitter and on Facebook sort of listeners, and you are reachable again yet on Twitter. Once again, you're back. I don't know if you're back currently when we were last on, but you're
was gone. Gone.
That was in my that was in my dark period.
It's good. What made you come back? All right.
Thanks. It's funny. I woke up one day and said, "Yeah, I think I'll just go back on Twitter." I mean, it kind of happened completely randomly because I really wasn't going to, and then one day I just sort of woke up and thought, you know, I'll be okay.
I need to
and
tell
I just,
people about community, okay?
Well, that too. I was trying to save community, and it didn't happen.
I actually heard that Ryan was impersonating you, and led to you having
bastard.
To
he would.
Come back. And yeah,
I thought I'd revoked his internet privileges.
There's a cafe down
the
street.
You gotta change your password.
Yeah, evidently he found a way around it. No, it was just one of those things where I did miss engaging with the audience, and I think I just developed a thicker skin over the years in terms of the nastier people it's a lot of fun now, and I've had a good time with it, and if someone bugs me, I either shoot back a response to get them to stop, and if they become more and more, if they become really disrespectful, I just block them. But I even try to not do that. I mean, I, because, you know, that it's a public forum and people can say what they want, but, you know, obviously most people are looking for answers to questions that I simply can't give them. I mean,
right.
In that I can't, like, it's professionally inappropriate for me to answer those questions. You know, I can't tell you what's going to happen next, and I can't tell you a lot of reasons for why we changed things, because it's just not appropriate for me to do that. It's, you know, I'm not the showrunner, but I appreciate the fans. I don't want to make that, you know, I want to make that clear. It's not that I don't understand those questions. It's just I really can't answer them.
I think we get that.
And yeah, it's fun. It's fun to engage. I'm happy to, you know, promote the show there. But I'm very glad I'm back. I did miss it.
Yeah. Well, welcome back. And Brian is B_Cogman on Twitter for everybody. We're going to give you
me.
Our Twitter a little later on. But we did get some questions on Twitter that I think we should read now.
Yeah, I like this one that comes from Manu. His name is actually Manuclear Bomb on Twitter, which I think is a pretty good Twitter handle.
That's a good one.
Yes, it's pretty
and
good.
He asks, what one character who has been cut and would have already appeared in the series? So he's getting, you know, not going down the spoiler route. Do you miss the most?
You know, it's, again, it's not really a question I can answer, because, you know, a character who hasn't appeared yet might still appear. Or, I mean, you know, for instance, Jojen and Mira weren't in season 2, but they appeared later. I probably can't answer that, because if I then mention a character didn't appear that I know is not going to appear, I've now confirmed that character is not appearing. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's a slippery slope. Yeah,
it's something I'm afraid I cannot. I would have said Sir Pounce, but I righted that wrong. Lady Whiskers. I miss Lady Whiskers.
Oh, okay.
Sir Pounce. Lady Whiskers is Sir Pounce's other friend,
female
counterpart.
Yeah,
I see.
Boots and Lady Whiskers have not yet appeared. I don't. Oh, here we go. Breaking news. Breaking
Tell
news.
Us more.
For character reasons, they haven't appeared.
They are not going to. You will not meet
Bring
Lady Whiskers.
Bring back Boots.
Yeah,
Bring
it's not
going to
happen.
Boots.
So send in your hate mail now. Lady Whiskers is not going to be on Game of Thrones.
I miss Nymeria. Where is she at?
Nymeria did appear on the show.
No, that's right.
You guys are not.
I miss Syrio Pharrell.
We've never watched Syrio.
I
want to
know everything.
Syrio did appear on the show. Well, Syrio, I'll tell you what happened to Syrio. Syrio died.
Did he really? Can you confirm that? Because I've been holding out hope.
Well, George has confirmed that.
I know, but you, Brian, change it, man.
He's dead.
Bring him back.
He was facing off, as the Hound said, he was facing off against Kingsguard with a wooden sword.
Oh, but we can't go by what the Hound says because Ramsay, in your episode, was shirtless. Didn't have any armor.
Yeah. To be fair, I didn't write in the shirtless.
Well, there you go.
No armor. I did
write
in the armor.
So glad you did.
But anyway, he's dead.
Brian, I wanted to mention Hodor being picked and prodded by the men. That was
I know, that was mean, wasn't it?
Yeah, we all had an intake of breath and went, "Aw." Yeah.
Again, this is a cruel world, you know. No one is safe.
Yeah, question from Johan Spore, I think, on Twitter.
Oh, I know Johan.
Oh, you know Johan. Okay.
I just remember that handle.
The question is, in Oathkeeper and The Laws of Gods and Men, Brian has written two of the best scenes in the series.
I knew I liked Johan.
Yeah,
I
right,
told
right.
you.
Liking me better now. Jaime Brienne in the first one and Tyrion's trial in the second. So did he feel, this is you, did you feel that they would be excellent scenes already while at the writing stage?
Wow. Yes, I knew they were brilliant.
Ryan, get out of here.
People are going to think I paid you to ask that question. No, look, I think everything's terrible as I'm writing it. I'm a huge self-loathing, neurotic critic of my own work. The trial is, it's there in the book as being awesome. So I figured if I didn't screw it up too much, it would work.
Right.
The Jaime Brienne scene is sort of a combination of a few scenes and both are examples of the spine being laid out by George and me tweaking it here and there. But yeah, I was very happy with both of them. For the reasons we talked about earlier, but I never know if they're going to be great until I see the final cut. You know, I mean, there's so much that goes into making a scene, and I try to do my best to, you know, the goal of any script is you get as much information on that page as possible so that the rest of the artisans can do their work. And then you stay, I'm on set with them as much as I can to make sure I can help in any way, but it's ultimately, you know, out of my hands once I send it in.
How many times did you draft Tyrion's speech for this episode?
I think there were three drafts. I think I wrote the original version and then I got a note to maybe add some more to it and make it even bigger, and I did. And then I handed it in, and the guys did their pass, and they ended up cutting most of the new stuff and keeping kind of the original version.
There you go.
You know, and then that's typical. I mean, you know, you see what works.
So you proved it was good.
Maybe I purposely wrote really bad new stuff so that they would. No, I
playing the game.
I think there was a little more bile directed straight at his father about his childhood that I kind of added in, and it was probably ultimately decided that it just wasn't necessary. That speech, I mean, and you know, I'd say a great deal of that speech is either verbatim from the book or a slight rewording of something in the book, with a few additions, and subtractions, obviously. But, the major adaptation choice of that whole sequence had more to do with, the fact that the testimony mirrored the show as opposed to the books, and also we really tried to make it even more so than the book version that almost all the testimony is essentially true. It's just the context that's damning.
Right.
So that, and then of course the backroom deal with Jaime is an invention for the show that never happens in the book.
Right.
Yeah. And the idea behind that would be that we show that Tyrion might have a chance of getting out of this, and he chooses to throw that away.
I was excited for that.
Yeah, no, it was a really, that was a really wonderful, that backroom scene with him and Tywin was a very gratifying scene to write, and it turned out really well.
It sheds a lot of light on Tywin's mastery.
Oh, it does.
And his puppetry.
Oh, he said done right away.
Done.
Oh yeah, no, he knows his kids, and he knows how to play these situations, and you know, he had no way of knowing for sure if this situation would happen, but he obviously thought it might and was ready to, you know, he has a contingency he has a plan for any contingency except for there at the end. He didn't have a plan for that. funnily enough, and this is just a production tidbit, but originally it was scripted to be in Tywin's office, like so many of those Tywin scenes are, and Charles Dance just had enough. He was like, if I have to do one more fucking scene behind his desk, he said, why can't we just move it in here? You know, and
this room, this is fine. Move the shit out of here. We'll just wipe this.
And the guys were on another unit shooting another scene. And I remember we were calling him being like, you know, can we move it to this? And they gave the okay. And I'm really glad they did. It visually is as Charles quite rightly pointed out, it gives some visual variety to them.
Yeah, no, that's great.
And it kind of it's even more kind of chilling because he's sitting there in his little sunroom having his lunch.
He's like the judge that adjourns, so he can go have a sandwich.
Well, that was the idea. I mean, it really was sort of the kind of play on the whole. If Jaime is sort of taking on the role of counselor to Tyrion, and Tywin is the judge, it was sort of meant to be kind of a classic backrooms chamber scene that you would see in those courtroom dramas. So that was that. It was fun. It was fun to write and fun to shoot, and they, you know, played it beautifully.
But of course, then when they come back from adjourning, they get Shay's testimony, and that throws, I think, everything off its axis. It throws Tyrion into his rant. It throws Tywin's plans out. And Jaime's too as well for sort of the whole and continuing the family name, everything gets ruined because of what Shay does to Tyrion. And we got a few questions about that. I have one from my friend Andrew, and there's one on Facebook as well. I'm going to try and kind of combine the two, but essentially, because in the books, Shay is a point of view character who exists like in Tyrion's perspective, and in the show, we've seen sort of more dimensions about, you know, how he has to let her go, the effect that it has on him, you know, in doing so. But she appears, I guess, in the books being more one-sided, as if she had always been fake, I guess, to him was one interpretation that I heard. Whereas now it seems like she's either scorned or has been coerced by Cersei or something. So how do you handle specifically Shay? Because she kind of threw a wrench in everybody's plans, and I'm just not sure what she was even doing there, just because she undid Tywin's plans. So I'm like, would Tywin have ever really put her there? Like, what's going on here? It's just such a huge cog in the whole machine here. I'm wondering, like, what was the process like adapting that from the book? And is it meant to raise, like, as many questions about was she coerced and who's, you know, really throwing this trial?
Well, it's absolutely meant to raise those questions, which is why I probably shouldn't really answer them. Without question, the Shay-Tyrion relationship was altered pretty significantly for the purposes of the show and to being more of a real love story between the two of them. And her backstory and her relationship with Sansa, all of that is markedly different than in the books. Mm-hmm. It was definitely meant to be a love story that we knew would build up to this moment of betrayal. Her motives and the exact circumstances of how she got there, I think it's better to leave that vague. That said, I mean, you know, it was made pretty clear that Cersei was the one preparing the witnesses, not Tywin. Tywin wasn't lying when he said, I'm a judge and I'm going to have to be impartial.
Right.
So he wasn't preparing the case against him. That was Cersei.
Okay.
Now, Tywin knew about her because the handmaiden, you know, reported to the two of them.
Right.
So he certainly, you know, knew about it to a point. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a different take on the character and on the relationship than in the book.
But Tyrion's heartbroken. We're heartbroken watching it.
Yeah,
I was heartbroken because she was supposed to be on a boat. I'm like, what does that mean about what Bronn said? And what does it mean about this? And
they go back and look at the beginning of episode 3. Tywin's first line is, stop all the ships in the port.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Nobody leaves the capital.
Yeah, nobody leaves the capital.
There you go. Oh, so doesn't she know? Doesn't Shay know that he did what he did because he loves her and he wanted to keep her safe?
It'll be okay, Eric.
You know, the human heart and the complexities of
love is war.
You know, it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing. It's messy. It's gray. It's Game of Thrones.
We keep trying to tell him this. He's not.
It's great. Like, yeah, the characters on Game of Thrones. It must be awesome to be you.
There's a good chance her life was threatened, Eric. I mean,
yeah.
You gotta remember who you're dealing with here.
Yeah, it's a mess. It is a joy for a writer because there's no easy out and there's no, you know, there are no white knights. And I mean, I guess there are some pretty clear cut villains. I mean, Carl's a villain, but, But even Carl has his reasons for being there, and there's a life story that got him to that place. I mean, you know, George's books, and I hope our show approaches all of these characters as human beings and not as archetypes. And, you know, that can make for a very uncomfortable viewing, and it causes a lot of debate and a lot of pretty heated debate about, you know, and people who are in very specific camps in terms of their favorite characters and or feel very personal about their favorite characters and how they're portrayed and how other people see them. And that's great. That's, you know, I think you're telling a good story if that's the conversation. If everyone feels the same way about every character in a story, you know, it's might be entertaining and but I don't think it's the kind that sticks with you,
right,
or demands repeat viewings. And I think, you know, George's books and hopefully our adaptation of them, it falls into the latter category.
I guess wrapping up, you know, going off of what you just said, you know, clearly there's material that has been brought into this season, that's new. Clearly there's material that's been brought in that's the book readers are aware of, but maybe didn't expect to see this soon. Mm-hmm. And I know you have to be very careful how you answer this question, but
sure.
You know, knowing that we're moving into next season and knowing that a lot of or several character storylines have advanced significantly to where some readers are in the series, you know, how do you deal with that? You know, we all know that you know a lot more than we do, but you know, what are some of those challenges like? I mean. And do you think we will continue to see some new material, you know, in next season that might be a little bit further along than where the books are?
I mean, I can't really talk about, you know.
You tried, Micah.
I tried.
That was a very thoughtfully worded question.
That was for you.
I appreciate that. I really obviously can't talk about season five, but, you know, all the decisions that are made in terms of adaptation that David and Dan have to make, ultimately it has to be about, you know, what is the best way as they see it to tell this story in this medium. Mm-hmm. And that's what guides that. So yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, my job is to help them in any way I can realize that vision. And, it's a huge saga, and there's no clear cut way to just transfer it to the screen. It's takes a bit of puzzle work and a bit of imagination and a bit of killing. Not really our babies, I guess they're George's babies, but
you've adopted them.
Killing babies, probably
killing Craster's babies.
I was going to say killing babies is probably not the right expression given our show, but it's a challenge. It's been a challenge ever since the beginning, and it, certainly as the and I've said this before, I mean, as the books expand, it becomes even more of a challenge in how do we wrestle this thing into the best television show that we can make.
Right.
You know, it's an ongoing thing, and it's what keeps us up at night, and it does. You know? And it certainly keeps David and Dan up more than me, because they're, you know, they I mean, you have no, I can't express enough to the listeners and to the fans just what a 24-hour a day, 365 a day a year job show running a show of this size, you know, what that entails. I mean, there's no vacation for them. Like, it is a, you know, everyone says, why can't you make 10 episodes? Yeah, they can't. We can't. It's 10 episodes is it. You couldn't make 11 because every single day is spent in making these 10 episodes. And, you know, it really is, you know, they've dedicated their lives to it.
And you keep adding more characters and more places. I mean,
yeah.
You can't add more episodes. You're going to go out of your mind. No,
I mean, it's physically not possible.
I mean, it's like a 10-hour, a high quality 10-hour movie every single year.
Well, we try. I mean, it's shot that way. I mean, it's shot, you know, it's shot completely out of sequence, like a 10-hour movie. It's not shot like a TV show where you go episode by episode, and most shows are writing the show as they are
right.
Shooting. Well, we can't do that. We have to have the entire thing written before we start pre-production, because it's there's nothing. I mean, I say this without any hesitation. There's nothing like this on television. There's no production like this on television. No one else is crazy enough.
Yeah.
It's just what it requires from everyone to. You know, get this thing off the ground is just astonishing. And it's been like grad school for me to sort of witness it, you know.
Well, I know we're excited to see the rest of the season. We're at the
Thank
second
you.
Half.
We're just over the hump, yeah. And it accelerates from here. I mean, these next four episodes are just a roller coaster. I mean, they really are. It's
buckle up, people.
It's all kinds of crazy. You know, it really awesome. Is. So, and I'm really excited for everyone to see them.
Well, yeah. I think that we should collectively take our breaths. That's it.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Brian.
You, Brian.
My pleasure. I enjoyed talking.
This was super cool. Yeah, was... You're such a humble, awesome guy.
Oh well, thanks.
Yeah,
I try.
Yeah,
I try. I mean, I look. I mean, I know. It's not lost on me that I stumbled on the greatest gig in Hollywood, and I don't let myself forget that because it's very humbling to work on something this massive and this of this quality. So I'm afraid it's spoiled me for the rest of my career. It's all just going to go downhill for me.
Well, it's great that you're having fun with it. It seems like
No, I mean, if you don't, then you're a fucking asshole.
Yeah,
I mean,
right?
Exactly.
No, I said that. I say to my friends,
round of applause.
Bitching about my job, just slap me across the face.
With a trout, if you have one with you.
There you go.
It's got to be a pretty serious undertaking, you know, doing what you do. I know you're, as Kate said, you're very humble about it, but... you know, you really put out some great work. I enjoy watching it, and I think I speak for everybody else here when I say that.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Wait, Eric's got another question.
Kate,
she's here.
What?
She's still here.
What? Eric,
Kate,
yes.
Tell Brian about the coin.
Oh.
Tell Brian about Baelish and the coin while we're here. Yes.
I have a theory that Peter and Varys, intentionally or not, I'm going to assume intentionally, represent the greeting, which is Bravosi, I believe, mm-hmm. Which is the Valar Morghulis, all men must die, mm-hmm. and Valar Dohaeris, all men must serve. Mm. And I think that Peter and Varys are the two sides of that coin. Peter being Valar Morghulis and Varys being Valar Dohaeris.
I like that.
All men must serve.
Actually, I really like that.
Thank you.
I really like that. I'm having lunch with George tomorrow. I'll ask him about that.
Yeah, just throw up.
I really am.
Oh my gosh.
I'm having lunch with him tomorrow. So I'll throw that one at him and see what he says.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm turning red. This is awesome.
It's a cool theory. I like that. I haven't heard that before. I'll tell George about it tomorrow.
There you go.
Where are you guys going for lunch?
Right. Nice try.
Well, no. By the time this gets out, lunch will be over.
I'm not saying a damn word.
Yeah. Good call. Well, Brian, it was a pleasure having you on. Our listeners, I'm sure, sitting at home, gleefully smiling, and probably sad that the episode is coming to an end.
It was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you. And thanks again for the kind words.
Well, from our hearts to yours, people listening at home, I guess we should say goodbye. So, see ya.
Goodbye.
All right. Our hearts to yours.
Bye. It's bath time.